Programming on NPR is supported by Ecolab, dedicated to improving cleaning and sanitation standards for leading hospitality, healthcare, and food processing customers worldwide. On the web at ecolab.com.
6 minutes now past 11 o'clock. And good morning. Welcome to Midday on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Gary Eichten. Glad you could join us. State of Minnesota has a projected budget surplus of nearly $3 billion, a large amount of money even by government standards. And Governor Jesse Ventura made it clear in his State of the State address that if he has his way, most of that extra money will be used for tax rebates, tax relief, and tax reform. As for state spending, the governor says it's time to hold the line. A little for inflation increases, but primarily that's it. Well, today on Midday, we're going to take a closer look at how that hold-the-line approach would affect the state's largest budget item, public education. Education spending consumes about a third of all state spending. Over the last 10 years, total state K-12 spending doubled, while inflation was up about 25%. What's more, last year, the state sharply increased its spending on education. However, many educators say that last year's increase did not make up for years of what they consider to be underfunding of public education, and they say a 2% increase this year would leave many school districts short of money. Today we've been joined by Laura Bloomberg, who is a Monomedi School Board member and the chair of the Association of Metropolitan School Districts. That's an organization that represents 27 urban and suburban school districts. And also with us is St. Paul DFL State Senator Sandy Pappas, the new chair of the State Senate Education Committee. And as always, we invite you to join our conversation. We're talking about education spending this hour. And if you'd like to join our conversation, give us a call here, 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. If you're calling from outside the Twin Cities, you can reach us toll-free at 1-800-242-2828. Now, before we get started with our conversation, let's hear what the governor had to say about education last week in his State of the State message.
Education, arguably our most important responsibility and for sure our greatest challenge to reform, but reform we must. We have a great history of education reform in this state, but now is not the time to rest on our laurels. We must meet the challenge of filling teacher vacancies in certain subject areas, including math and science. We must meet the challenge of teacher compensation in general, and we must meet the challenge of being accountable to the taxpayers for the billions we spend on education in Minnesota. Therefore, increases in my budget for K-12 education spending will be limited and targeted. My budget will include options that propose to facilitate alternative ways of paying teachers and alternative pathways to teaching. This last biennium, with tripartisan support, we increased K-12 spending by $1.3 billion. Still, most local school districts would like much more. But I am skeptical because I believe that most districts have not shown taxpayers the benefit of the last budget increase. I do know that some districts are working hard to focus more of their existing money on improving student learning. It can be done. From Mabel Canton to Minneapolis to Minnetonka, teachers, school boards, and administrators are having some healthy discussions about establishing priorities and finding new ways to do things with the same old money. And you know what? The world is not crashing to a halt. What I will recommend in my budget are ways to support new teachers in the classroom by supporting those districts that can think and act outside the box. My budget will support those districts that provide mentoring support and create new career pathways that help teachers stay in their chosen profession. I will propose ways to support getting new teachers and non-teachers into the classroom by loosening and fixing license requirements and compensation plans. We all know today that the least productive teacher gets paid the same as the most productive teacher. Obviously, there is not a great cost benefit to this system, especially in a full employment economy. I am proposing that when a teacher is a superior performer, that teacher be paid accordingly.
That was Governor Jesse Ventura in his State of the State address last week. Now, again, joining us to share their thoughts on school funding and how much is enough is Laura Bloomberg from Montemita. She's the chair of the Association of Metropolitan School Districts and State Senate Education Committee Chair Sandy Pappas. Both of them are joining us from the Sheraton Midway in St. Paul, where the association is holding a conference on teacher compensation reform. Again, we invite you to join our conversation as well. Give us a call here at 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. Outside the Twin Cities, 1-800-242-2828. Senator Pappas, Ms. Bloomberg, thank you for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good morning.
Well, let me start with you, Laura Bloomberg. Do you think a 2% per year increase in education funding is going to be enough?
Well, I think that an increase in funding is a good idea. I think that as we listen to what the governor said in his State of the State address, he talked about a tremendous influx of funds for public education in the last biennium. What he didn't tell you, though, was that the dollar amount per student in our school districts now has still not caught up with inflation. We're lagging far behind, and we need to catch up. We know that quality costs money, and without the funds to provide that quality, we won't be able to achieve or continue to achieve the things that the governor would like us to see. So it's not enough. It's a start, but what we need to do is catch up with inflation. And as I say, we're about $165 per pupil or per pupil unit, which is kind of a weighted average, behind where we should be if we accounted for inflation.
Mm-hmm. Senator Pappas, these numbers can get kind of confusing, per pupil formulas and the rest. But bottom line, do you think a 2% per year increase is going to be sufficient for Minnesota schools?
No, I agree with Laura that's almost an insult, that our schools have been not given adequate resources over the last decade. And part of that was an effort to target the state's resources on crucial areas and also to build more accountability into the system. And we spent a lot of time in developing testing and high standards for our students. But now we have the resources where we have a huge surplus, and it's really more productive to use that surplus to invest in our kids. And it certainly can still be very targeted. We know that our schools are strapped. Some of their general education dollars are tight because there are lots of cross subsidies involved in the system to fulfill state mandates. Schools are spending a lot of money on special education, on English language learners, and dealing with catch-up programs for children who do not come to school ready to learn. And we could definitely put more targeted resources into those areas. But the overall system, we're talking about a shortage of teachers. And if you don't have the resources to attract beginning teachers at a higher beginning salary, and then hold them accountable and hold them to high performance standards, absolutely. But if we don't have those initial resources to attract them, then we're not going to get the best and the brightest into education.
Mm-hmm. One of the arguments that the governor made last week was that given the substantial, he didn't sense that the money that was appropriated last year and the year before was well spent, or at least he didn't get the sense that the school districts have made the case that the money was well spent. Would you agree with that part of his analysis, that there is a kind of, mistrust, if you will?
I think the governor is sincerely reflecting the feeling of the public at large, and many of the public at large does not have children in the school system. I think if you talk to teachers and parents with kids in the school system, then they know that, you know, their systems are nickel and diming their neighbors and their friends and their relatives to try to raise extra dollars to buy what I would argue is essential school supplies and equipment, and not extras. So I think the governor, it would be helpful if he listened to his lieutenant governor more, who is out and about and really visiting with the schools, and not so much to the folks that just want a tax rebate.
Mm-hmm. Laura Bloomberg, would you agree? Do you think in general there is a perception that the money has not been well spent, or is the governor completely off base here?
Well, actually, I see those as two different questions. I don't agree with the governor that the money has not been well spent. I also do agree with Senator Pappas that there may be the public perception out there in some arenas that it's not been well spent. I think that's for a couple of reasons. First of all, I'm not sure that educators traditionally are all that good at tooting their own horns. We have tremendous examples of excellence in our schools, and I don't know as though we're very skilled in promoting that. Generally, the media hasn't always been very helpful in that regard as well. We tell a lot of stories about failure in our schools and perhaps not as many about the great successes. I do think that good things have happened with the influx of funds in the last couple of years. On the other hand, there are hidden costs that the public may not know about, like, excuse me, for example, escalating health care costs. School districts are large employers. There are a number of people whose benefits cost the district tremendous amounts of money. Those kinds of costs aren't readily apparent to the public. Another good example of that is just simply what it costs to heat our schools right now. The energy costs are killing some school districts. Additionally, we want our schools to provide state-of-the-art technology options for our students. Yet technology and keeping up with changing technology is a very pricey thing to do. So there are those kinds of costs that may not be that apparent to the public that are also sucking up resources in districts.
Mm-hmm. A couple more questions, and I want to get to some listener calls here. Is the problem essentially one of overall state spending, or is it more a question of district by district? That is to say, are some districts actually doing pretty well right now, others are suffering, or are all districts in dire straits?
I don't think it's a dire strait situation, but I do think there are that some of that is relative. You may have a western suburban district that, because their property taxpayers were willing to give them more money, had more resources than some other districts that did not have that local capacity in the past. But now and so they weren't complaining as much. They weren't as concerned. But now I think that situation has changed, that as people see the quality of their schools disintegrating, you know, and the quality may have started at a different level, but if they see that downgrading, then to them, they don't have the kind of resources that they need to really educate their kids. So I do think that these are problems across the state. In rural Minnesota, and actually 80% of our districts now are in decline, meaning they have less pupils than they used to have, meaning they get less money from the state. So, and that creates difficulties, because if you have a class of 30 students and you lose two or three students in that class, you still have to pay the teacher. Your fixed costs are the same, but you don't have the same amount of dollars, because we do provide money from the state on a per pupil basis. So, you know, we have problems, different problems across the state, but they all seem to center around that this state has not made a commitment to really dedicate our surplus resources to educating our kids.
Mm-hmm. And before we get to callers here, a number from each of you. The governor is talking about 2% a year. What percentage overall state spending for education do you think is not just bare bones sufficient, but would really meet school needs? How much of an increase? Laura Bloomberg, you want to go first?
Well, AMSD, the Association for Metropolitan School Districts, proposal for this year is to first have a formula, a per pupil increase of $165 to make up for past underfunding, and then a 2.5% inflationary increase for each year of the biennium.
Okay, and that, just to help us with our math here, $165 per student, or per pupil, rather,
right.
Added on top of the 2.5%, what would the percentage increase be then?
Well, overall, it would be roughly about $400 per student over the biennium increase. So we're talking, we're talking about a lot of money.
10%. If we provide roughly $4,000 per student or per WADM, we would say that would be about a 10% increase.
Okay. We're talking this hour about school financing in the state of Minnesota. As you probably heard, Governor Ventura essentially is calling for a hold-the-line budget, suggesting that schools and other state agencies, for that matter, essentially keep spending increases to about 2%, more or less inflation. Many educators say that's not nearly enough for public education. And we've been joined today by Laura Bloomberg, who is the chair of the Association of Metropolitan School Districts. Sandy Pappas is also with us. She's a DFLer from St. Paul. She is the new chair of the State Senate Education Committee. And if you'd like to join our conversation, give us a call here, 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. Outside the Twin Cities, you can reach us toll-free, and that number is 1-800-242-2828, 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. I'm trying to decide to talk about how much money the schools need to provide the kind of education that people expect they're going to provide. Nick, you're up first. Go ahead, please.
Good afternoon. This is Nick from St. Louis Park.
Yes.
And I guess I have two things I'd like to comment on. The first one is administrative compensation. No one has spoken to this at all. We are losing many very fine administrators to industry, and I know this firsthand, and I won't speak to exactly who they are, and then they go and they hire people that are totally unqualified.
Okay.
I mean, they have the certificate, but other than that, forget it.
Okay.
And then the second one is I am holding in my hand a certificate of commendation from the governor of Minnesota, Jesse Ventura. And so far, my spouse has not received any recognition other than a small dinner that was given to them. There was nothing in the paper, nothing on the radio. And this is just one of the awards she's won. I mean, come on, let's be real now.
Okay, so you're
I'll go ahead and hang up and listen to what you fine people have to say.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right.
Well, if I could speak to that quickly. This is Laura Bloomberg speaking. Mm-hmm. The issue of administrative compensation is part of a much bigger issue about compensation for educational professionals. And it is true that we are losing educational professionals to other parts of the work world at an alarming rate. As I said, quality costs money, and for us to compensate teachers and administrators at a level that will retain people in the profession is a significant consideration.
So that you think that 10% increase that you're talking about, that would get pay up to a point where you wouldn't be losing the good administrators, you would be paying the teachers enough?
I'll let Senator Pappas respond to that one.
Gary, I'm kind of new in this job, so I wouldn't even like to say 10% until we have a chance to kind of look at the budget and hear from school districts. But we do have an impending crisis with the departure of the retirement of many administrators. Many administrators are, we don't have enough people in the pipeline. And I think when the governor talks about looking outside the box, I would agree that it's important to do that. And just as we feel that that individuals who have expertise in a content area should be able to be fast-tracked to become teachers, as long as we maintain our standards, I think we also could look at ways that we could recruit administrators who have a management or business background, but may not necessarily have been teachers. Obviously, there has to be some familiarity there with educational systems, but so that they can be the educational leader in their school district. But I think we can be creative in that area. But it doesn't mean that we would be able to attract non-teachers to be administrators if the compensation package is not adequate, any more than we can encourage teachers to get their administrator's license.
Mm-hmm. Is the governor on to something here, though, in terms of targeting? He does want to target the additional money that education would receive to new ways to pay, and he specifically talking about teachers. Good idea?
Well, it's just not an either or. We certainly can use some state resources to encourage creativity and accountability and change within a system that is very slow to change. We would all agree that it's very difficult to make any kind of institutional change. But we can't neglect the basic support that we need to provide our school systems.
Mm-hmm.
I agree with that. I think that we need to be clear here that when we talk about a 10% increase, we're talking about what is necessary for schools to operate, and it accounts for inflationary increases only. On top of that, we need to talk about things like eliminating the special ed cross subsidy, which Senator Pappas spoke about earlier. And when we talk about different ways of compensating teachers, I think realistically we have to say that is going to cost more money as well. And I know, I recognize the governor's point about school districts continually asking for more money. I think the reality is, though, that it will cost that amount of money to provide the kind of education that we need to provide for students to be prepared for the workplace of the 21st century.
We've just gone through 10 years of massive change and asking teachers to develop and implement high standards for students, and we absolutely need to do that. And now we're looking at asking teachers to undergo another change in developing systems of high standards for themselves. And it becomes overwhelming at a certain point. I wish a lot of the public in Minnesota and your listeners would spend some time in schools. I mean, this is a very tough job that we're asking them to do. A couple years ago, I got my substitute teacher's license and actually spent a couple weeks subbing in different schools because I felt that if I wanted to be an educational policymaker, it was really important. And I'm also a part-time college teacher as well. But it's not just a 40-hour work week. It's not a 9-to-5. It's not an 8-to-5 job. It is teachers work far beyond that, and they have 10-month contracts. And so it looks like they have all this great vacation time, but I think it's rest and recuperation time because of their 60-hour work week that they have to put in the rest of the year. So it's a tough job, and I think it would help if we all, as public supporters of education, like the listener, the caller just mentioned, that his wife is working hard and yet, is not really thanked enough. And I want to say right now, thank you, all you hardworking teachers out there. You're doing a great job.
Chris, your comment, please.
Oh, my name's Chris. My wife is a chemistry teacher in a local school district, and she actually does not have her license. She is an unlicensed teacher, and I have a couple of questions and issues to raise, and then I'll hang up. The first part being that despite the fact that she has a master's degree, she's had to go back to school while she's teaching, and we've had to pay probably about $10,000 for her to receive her license to do a job that she already has and is getting paid on a per-month basis, and I use per-month intentionally, substantially less than she would if she was using her chemistry degree and then her other educational background in industry. And then the other issue is people talk about paying teachers and how to do that more, but one of the issues that she's run into is in terms of the union, because the union for teachers controls the pay for all teachers. So a new teacher in physical education with their background doesn't gets paid the same as a teacher in chemistry who, if they were in the marketplace, the chemistry teacher with their skills would get paid much, much more. Okay. And I was wondering if you could address both of those issues.
Okay, we have to break here for news fairly soon, and these are meaty issues, both of which, but quick comments on them, if you would, please. Opening up the profession, making it a little easier for people to actually get into the classroom, and then the issue of whether or not some teachers, based on what they teach, ought to get paid more.
the caller brings up a really good issue because people do change careers, and we want to encourage that. But to have somebody in mid-career come into teaching at a starting teacher's salary is a real disincentive. So that's something very important that school districts as well as the state needs to look at. And I don't believe that we have unlicensed teachers unless perhaps in a private school. She would be licensed as a community expert, and she's allowed to work as a community expert for several years. But he also brings up a good point, is that we do need fast-track systems to provide the ability for people to get their full credentials more quickly. And as a high school chemistry teacher, the methods, learning the methods of teaching are not nearly as important as the content. And clearly, as as a science expert, she has the content down, and we should be able to get her into full credentialed with a few summer programs and some weekend programs.
Laura Bloomberg, do you think the compensation system needs to be changed such that people who teach a given subject get paid quite a bit more in some cases than people who teach something else?
Well, I think the teacher compensation system needs to be changed. It needs to be looked at. In terms of paying people differently based on their content area of expertise, I think we need much more discussion about what that would look like. Chris's comment about the union being inflexible, I'd just like to add that Education Minnesota is also looking at this issue, and my sense is that they are very interested in thinking about alternative teacher compensation as well. So I think that we'll see changes from that arena as well.
We're speaking about education spending in the state of Minnesota this hour of midday. Governor Ventura last week in his State of the State message indicated he'd like to hold the line more or less, 2% a year mostly to cover inflationary costs. Many educators say that's not nearly enough. And if you'd like to join our conversation, give us a call here, 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. We'll get to more of your calls in just a couple of minutes.
Is what Gapsoman say is a crucial decision.
Take one part rap and one part soca, and you have Rapso, Caribbean dance music with a streetwise message. I'm Lisa Mullins, Rapso from Trinidad's Brother Resistance, and the day's news coming up next time on The World.
That's today at 7 o'clock here on Minnesota Public Radio. A reminder that Minnesota Public Radio is member-supported. If you've recently sent in your membership renewal, we thank you. News headlines now. Here's Greta Cunningham. Greta?
Good morning, Gary. Education Secretary-designate Rod Paige is drawing praise from both Republicans and Democrats at his confirmation hearing today. Paige told lawmakers he supports public schools, but he showed no sign of backing down from his support of vouchers for private schools. In his prepared testimony, Paige said failing schools should be given the chance to turn themselves around, but he said if they don't, parents should have the option of using their share of federal funds to pay for tutoring, a charter school, or non-public school. Democrats have made it clear they support Paige but oppose the idea of using federal money for private schooling. President-elect Bush says his first official visit to the Pentagon was great. He had no further comment before he waved goodbye and then left the building with his national security team. Bush, Vice President-elect Cheney, and Donald Rumsfeld, defense secretary-designee, were among those who got a briefing in the Pentagon secure room. Outgoing Defense Secretary William Cohen and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Hugh Shelton, provided an official briefing for the Bush team. The military leaders are hoping Bush will increase his defense budget. They'd like to see another $50 billion for defense modernization. American Airlines says it's good news for the flying public, but travel agents and others aren't so sure. American's chief executive says the purchase of most of TWA by American will mean greater efficiency for the airline, but critics say it'll mean fewer choices and higher prices for flyers. In regional news, Republican Minnesota Senator Dick Day is ready to roll out the sequel to the Freedom to Drive agenda he pressed last year. Day will discuss his On the Road Again transportation agenda today. The proposal seeks to remedy behind-the-wheel annoyances. The forecast for Minnesota today calls for sunshine statewide and mild temperatures. Highs today ranging from 35 in the north to 42 in the southwest. At this hour, mostly sunny skies reported throughout the region. Duluth reports sunshine and 28 degrees. Skies are clear in Rochester and 27. It's sunny in St. Cloud and 28. And in the Twin Cities, sunny skies, a temperature of 34. Gary, that's a look at the latest news.
Thanks, Greta. 25 minutes before noon. This is Midday on Minnesota Public Radio. This hour, we are talking about state spending on public education. And joining us is Sandy Pappas, who is a state senator from St. Paul. She is the new chair of the State Senate Education Committee. Laura Bloomberg is with us as well. She's from Montemedi. She's a Montemedi school board member. She is also chair of the Association of Metropolitan School Districts, an organization that represents urban and suburban school districts. And again, if you'd like to join us, give us a call, 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. John, your comment, please.
Thank you for taking my call. I'd first like to say that I'm a retired teacher of 35 years. I taught in higher education. I would like to just point out, and you probably maybe are aware of this, that many teachers, especially in the primary grades and the K through 12 system, spend their own funds to get supplies that they desperately need for their classrooms, and there's not enough money in the budgets to cover these. And I have friends that have spent, you know, $400 or $500 a year of their own money for that purpose. That's entirely, wrong, I think. And when I was teaching, I was told one year that there wasn't enough money for ditto paper. I had to go buy my own. Now, I mean, I wonder how the governor would like that if he had to go buy his own paper clips and pencils and paper and other supplies, or the senator would like that, or other people in business. I think they would cry foul very quickly. I'd like to comment on that, please.
All right. Thank you, John. This comes up quite a bit when we do these education programs, and it always seems mysterious. We have these what appear to be huge increases in spending, and yet we consistently hear that teachers have to go out and buy papers and pencils and the rest for the kids. How can that be?
Well, there are only huge increases in spending because we spend a huge amount of dollars on kids. But if you look at it as $4,000 per kid, basic money, we have a lot of kids to educate. Now, half our state budget goes towards education. So, I heard an example the other day to just increase the subsidy we provide to school lunches, a penny per lunch means $1 million. So that's why it seems like a huge amount of money. It's probably more reasonable to look at it instead as how much additional money we're spending on each additional kid. Because we do, most of the dollars does go toward teacher salaries, and there's not a lot, and they're still underpaid, and there's not a lot of money left over for other things. So it's not just supplies, it's clerical support. Teachers should be considered professionals, but yet they don't have any kind of clerical support, very little, depending on the school, that can, you know, run off Xerox copies or even talk to parents. They don't have telephones. That was a big issue a few years ago, is teachers not having telephones in their rooms, getting very limited break time. They don't have an hour to go out for lunch. You know, they eat in the cafeteria many times with their students or work on lessons plans during their lunch hour. So it is, it's not really a professional situation the way we have it now. They're working folks, definitely.
Laura Bloomberg, one thing we also hear when we do these programs is that what money there is often gets siphoned off, never gets to the classroom. Is that a fair charge?
Well, I'd need more information about what you mean by siphoned off.
I guess generally the charges go that it gets locked up in some central administration, big bureaucracy, and on and on.
Well, I think, again, as I said earlier, there are a number of hidden costs that don't necessarily directly translate to what happens to a child in a classroom, but they're part of running a business, like health care costs for employees, like the cost of heating the buildings. And so in that respect, yes, there are additional costs. In terms of things getting wrapped up in bureaucracies within a school district, I can't speak across the board to that. I would be surprised if there were many instances of that in the state of Minnesota. I don't think that's the issue. I think the broader issue is, are we funding what we value? And it costs money. I think that John's comment about primary teachers spending their own money on supplies is a really telling example. It's an unfortunate example, but a telling example of just how committed some of our teachers are to what they do, and the fact that not only do they not have the supplies, but they're not compensated at a level that recognizes that is terribly unfortunate.
Audrey, your comment, please.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
You bet.
I know Senator Pappas. We just met recently at some meetings for funding for public education. And I just wanted to reiterate what I just heard said by Laura Bloomberg, and that was about the utilities and transportation costs. I'm on the Minneapolis Board of Education, and we're looking at our budget for next year, of course. Our utilities have doubled in the last few months. You know, the cost that we're paying, and of course that's also been seen in the in residential and commercial. Well, we have to pay those bills as well. We can't not heat our buildings. And our transportation costs because of the cost of fuel have gone up considerably. And in the private sector, of course, benefits are a major consideration in any employment issue and negotiation, and our benefits are also part of that. So those costs have gone up, and 2% doesn't even begin to touch where those costs have gone. So one of the things that used to happen from the funding that the school districts used to get was categorical spending, money that was for transportation and money that was for other things. Maybe utilities should be included in that so that we can actually see exactly where the money is going and how much money is going towards those things, because they really do, they're those things that people say, oh, they disappear into bureaucracies. And in Minneapolis, our overhead for administration is quite low. It's something around between 4% and 6% of our overall budget goes into that, and you know that's pretty low. So you know these are issues that I think we need to address.
Okay, that raises an issue which can get a little dense for people, but in terms of accountability to taxpayers, and in terms of schools being able to use their dollars most efficiently, what is better, to provide a lot of targeted money for specific programs, which seemed to be the trend during most of the 90s, or more general support in the so-called per-pupil aid formula, which is the direction the state's gone in the last 2 years? Which is better for schools? Laura Bloomberg?
So restate that. Which is better for schools, the dollars on the formula or...
Or these more targeted programs. You get some money for transportation, and you get some money for lower class sizes, and you get some money for extra teacher costs and that kind of thing. What's better?
I don't see it as an either-or. I can't speak specifically to which is better. Clearly, we just had this discussion this morning at the conference both Senator Pappas and I are attending. Clearly, we value local control. I believe strongly that local school districts need to make decisions about how dollars are allocated. So to that extent, I believe that general education dollars on the formula, if you will, or dollars per pupil to be allocated by local policymakers is important. On the other hand, when we're looking at escalating costs in particular areas, that needs to be recognized by the state, which is the primary funder of education. And if I could just add to that some specific information that's related to your question and also to what Audrey, who just called in, said, we're looking at a cost of diesel fuels increasing by 99% in the past 10 years. And Audrey also talked about transportation, and we're looking at the cost of contracted bus services up by 43% since 1991. So we need to think about targeted funds for some of those increases.
Mm-hmm. Senator Pappas, the folks you represent, I would imagine some of them, if they were listening, would tell you, well, gee, our energy costs are up a lot too, and our transportation costs are up a lot, and we want our money back. Send us our money back. Give us a tax cut.
Yeah, I imagine they would do that. I guess that in a perfect world, we could do all, but maybe we can do both. Certainly there's room for a balanced approach to increased spending on education and other key important issue areas like housing, for example. But there's also a room for looking at tax cuts in areas in which we feel high taxes are hurting our economic growth.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I mean, I used to be a tax chair, so we could go into a whole discussion on tax issues, but let's not. The role, getting back to this flexibility issue, is the, I think the role of the state is to is provide for the basic funding, to set standards, statewide standards, and then provide for local flexibility in how you meet those standards, and then to hold districts accountable. However, as you go, sometimes you have crises situations in which the state needs to do a little bit more in a targeted way, and I think the fuel issue may be one situation where, just like we have home fuel assistance programs for low-income people, we also could provide some fuel assistance for schools on a short-term basis.
Paul, your comment, please.
Yes, I'd like to echo a theme that seems to be recurring a lot in this radio program, and that is that teachers have a tremendously difficult job and are underpaid. My sister is a first-year Spanish teacher in Duluth, Minnesota, and I hear from her exactly what her day is like. I guess, thinking we really need to listen to teachers who are there in the classrooms as to what they need and respect that. And I'm a little concerned about some of Ventura's plans, for instance, like merit pay. How would that be executed in a fair and consistent manner across the state when teachers have such widely varying classroom situations? And so I guess I'd like to hear what your guests have to say about that.
Is there a way to tailor any kind of pay-for-performance program that will satisfy most people?
I can address that. I believe there is. I think Paul raises some important issues. Teachers are underpaid. I recognize that. The Association of Metropolitan School Districts recognizes that. His specific question about merit pay, though, first of all, I think it's important for all of us to recognize that we're not talking about merit pay when we're talking about alternative teacher compensation models. Traditionally and historically, merit pay models have talked about identifying a handful of teachers sort of at the top of the heap, if you will, and paying them more. And I don't think that that supports high-quality public education. But I do think it's feasible to think about an alternative compensation system that pays teachers for what they know and what they do, not for how long they've been in the classroom or how many degrees they have solely. Mm-hmm. So I think that's feasible to look at, and I think we can do it in a fair and equitable way. It won't be easy, and we can't do it quickly, but I think that there's support at the legislature and certainly support amongst educational leaders in the state to start looking at that.
Senator Pappas, is there a way, our caller mentioned starting, or kind of raised the issue of starting pay, is there a way to substantially increase what first-year teachers get as a starting salary without drastically increasing the amount spent on teacher pay overall? In other words, would the teachers at the top end be willing to give a little bit to give more to the people at the bottom?
I think that's a question you're going to have to ask the local districts and the local unions. I do believe that schools are in a position where they've got to raise that starting pay. And yes, there is always an equity issue as you look at people who've been in the system over a long period of time. But as Laura mentioned, we really have no choice. We have to look at different compensation models, and we have to work with our local teachers and our local districts in any way we can. And some of the conferences we've been going to, some of the hearings we've been having in the House and we'll have in the Senate, we'll be looking at ways as how we, the governor's office and the Department of Children, Family, and Learning as well, are all looking at different ways that we can provide models to districts. And certainly we have to look at financially assisting districts as well to reward teachers for taking on extra tasks, being leaders, being mentors to new teachers, for gaining different skill blocks that relate to student needs, because we want them always to be aligned with the standards and with what the students need, because achievement, we have to keep our eyes on the final goal, which is student achievement. To look maybe not so much at individual incentives, but at site, at school incentives. If the school as a whole improves
student achievement? How can all the staff, the teachers and the support staff, be receive an extra bonus? So there's really lots of creative things that states all over the country are doing. There's certainly lots of information out there and research, and we need to be kind of part of the movement to in exploring this issue.
Not a lot of time left, but let's get one more caller on here with a quick comment before we wrap up. Jim, comment, please.
Hi. In reference to an earlier caller whose wife was a chemistry teacher, making some reference to her expertise being worth more than a physical education teacher's expertise, I'm a retired science teacher, and I would just like to say that this stereotype of the physical education teacher being some former jock that can't do anything else is way off base. These people have an incredibly complex and incredibly important job, and they're just as highly trained as a person who's teaching chemistry. And one should not, you know, play one particular area of expertise against another.
Okay.
And the second point is on this merit pay issue. So much of what I see in education is the success of it is based on a cooperative paradigm. And when you introduce merit pay, and I taught at a place that had a merit pay system for the last 13 years, and you introduce a competitive paradigm, and there are some competitive people that end up not working well together, keeping things to themselves, and
okay.
it doesn't work. So thank you.
Gary, Laura, and I are not talking about merit pay.
Right.
We're talking about alternative compensation, and a lot of that is based on a cooperative model.
Mm-hmm.
That's a crucial point to make. Clearly, we don't want to see a scarcity model or competition between classroom teachers for a limited piece of the pie. We want to see quality teachers because we know it leads to improved student learning. And that's precisely why neither Senator Pappas or I are talking about a merit pay model.
Before we wrap up, back to one of the governor's central points, assuming more money, however much it might be, 2% or 10% or 50%, anyway, assuming more money is allocated for education, how should the general public measure whether that money has been well spent a year or two from now? Laura Bloomberg?
Well, I think in general the issue of accountability is one that we cannot shy away from. And I don't hear teachers or local policymakers or school districts in general wanting to shy away from that. We need to hold school districts accountable. And in the final analysis, we're talking about student learning and improved student achievement. I think we have a lot to learn in terms of how we measure that. We have some models in place. We certainly have our graduation standards. But we also need to realize that there are incremental measures of progress in the classroom that teachers, as professionals, are in the best position to assess and examine. But in general, I think the public can hold us accountable in the final analysis for improved student learning.
Senator Pappas?
It's also a long-term process, and perhaps it's appropriate to end with talking about this process begins at birth. That the brain research shows that children are incredible learners as infants, and at that point, parents need information about how to stimulate that growth. We need quality early childhood education that is preparing kids for formal learning in kindergarten and first grade, and it goes all the way up to the years in school to a point where we know that our juniors and seniors are now prepared for higher education. And we have lots of benchmarks that we've created and we are creating, and we just need to improve on those.
Thank you very much for joining us, subject I know that we'll hear a lot about over the next several months. Appreciate you joining us today.
Thank you for inviting us.
Our guest today, Laura Bloomberg from Montemedi, Chair of the Association of Metropolitan School Districts, and State Senator Sandy Pappas, who is a DFLer from St. Paul. She's the new chair of the State Senate Education Committee, joining us this first hour of our midday program to talk about state spending on public education. 5 minutes now before 12 o'clock.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday. It's the 10th of January, 2001. It's the birthday of poet Philip Levine, born in Detroit, 1928. Birthday of the historian Dumas Malone, born in Coldwater, Mississippi, 1892, remembered for his six-volume biography of Thomas Jefferson that came out between 1948 and 1981. A biography recently selected by Modern Library as one of the 100 greatest nonfiction books of the 20th century. It's the birthday of the poet Robinson Jeffers, born in Pittsburgh, 1887, son of a theologian. Entered medical school at the age of 19, dropped out, went into forestry at the University of Washington in Seattle, dropped out after a year, and went to California, where he got married, published his first volume of poetry, and built himself a tower in Carmel, where he lived the rest of his life. And it was on this day in 1863, the world's first underground passenger train opened in London, the Metropolitan Line. Before it opened, the Times of London wrote, "It is an insult to common sense to suppose that people would ever prefer to be driven amid palpable darkness through the foul subsoil of London." But nonetheless, it was an immediate success. Here's a poem by Philip Levine on his birthday, entitled On My Own. Yes, I only got here on my own. Nothing miraculous. An old woman opened her door expecting the milk, and there I was, 7 years old, with a bulging suitcase of wet cardboard and my hair plastered down and stiff in the cold. She didn't say come in. She didn't say anything. Her luck had always been bad, so she stood to one side and let me pass, trailing the unmistakable aroma of badger, which she mistook for my underwear. And so she looked upward, not to heaven, but to the cracked ceiling her husband had promised to mend, and she sighed for the first time in my life, that sigh which would tell me what was for dinner. I found my room and spread my things on the sagging bed, the bright ties and candy-striped shirts, the knife to cut bread, the stuffed weasel to guard the window, the silver spoon to turn my tea, the pack of cigarettes for the life ahead, and at last the little collection of worn-out books from which I would choose my only name, Morgan the Pirate, Jack Dempsey, the Prince of Wales. I chose Abraham Plain and went off to school wearing a cap that said Ford in the right script. The teachers were soft-spoken women smelling like washed babies, and the students fierce as lost dogs, but they all hushed in wonder when I named the 400 angels of death, the planets sighted and unsighted, the moment at which creation would turn to burned feathers and blow every which way in the winds of shock. I sat down and the room grew quiet and warm. My eyes asked me to close them. I did, and so I discovered the beauty of sleep, and that to get ahead, I need only say I was there, and everything would open as the darkness in my silent head opened onto seascapes at the other end of the world, waves breaking into mountains of froth, the sand running back to become the salt savor of the infinite. Mrs. Tarbox woke me for lunch, a tiny container of milk and chocolate cookies in the shape of Michigan. Of course, I went home at 3:30, with the bells ringing behind me, and four stars in my notebook, and drinking companions on each arm. If you had been there in your yellow harness and bright hat directing traffic, you would never have noticed me, my clothes shabby and my eyes bright. To you, I'd have been just an ordinary kid. Sure, now you know, now it's obvious, what with the light of the Lord streaming through the nine windows of my soul, and the music of rain following in my wake, and the ordinary air on fire every blessed day I waken the world. A poem by Philip Levine, On My Own, from his new selected poems, published by Alfred A. Knopf, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, brought to you by the people at 21NorthMain.com, where book lovers find 13 million gently read classics, bestsellers, and rare masterpieces on the web at 21NorthMain.com. Research by Rob Hardy. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Regional broadcasts of the Writer's Almanac are supported by